The first question is from David Barma from Bank of America. David, please switch on your microphone and go ahead.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my questions. Firstly, I wanted to kick off with Prima, please. What kind of run rate earnings contribution are you expecting from the business once the full underwriting is recaptured? And if you can also comment on the synergy potential from the deal, which I don't think is included in the multiple you've disclosed. And then secondly, on commercial line pricing at XL, could you please unpack a bit the +1.1%, if you could talk about the trends in the main business lines. And then lastly, on life and health and the short-term results, I guess I would have expected the combined ratio improvement to be a bit more front-end loaded than it seems to be. So could you please talk a little bit about the speed of improvement in the short-term combined ratio and whether you expect most of the target to be achieved this year? Thank you.
Thank you, David, for your three questions. I suggest that Patrick will talk about Prima run rate earnings contribution and synergy potential. And it's true that we have not included a lot because we also want to leave the Prima business completely separate. Secondly, on the commercial line pricing, Scott, if you could talk about the outlook and the trends. And then Alban, if you could talk about life and health, because we see within the numbers a currently different trend between health and the life part, i.e. protection. So, Patrick, Prima.
Yeah, thank you, David, for the question. So as it has been highlighted by Frédéric, I just want to go back to what makes the strong strengths of Prima. I want to give you some numbers. First, policies sold in 2015. In 2024, they had 4 million customers. So it's one of the, I would say, the greatest disruption we have seen from a digital model in Europe. When we look at what we consider being the earnings fully captured with the underwriting piece, we are at 87 million, and we have a CAGR growth in that business that has been around 40%. So it's pretty impressive. Our calculations give us an undiscounted core of around 90%. And this stems, as Frédéric said, from, I think, three or four sources of competitive advantage. First, superior pricing capabilities. They've really managed to anti-select, if you will, the market with a very technical pricing, far less mutualization than what you see in other players. The second one is the lean organization structure with a non-commission expenses, which is best in class in the market, and the expense ratio as well. And a very strong cross-sell of ancillaries, far greater, almost the double that what you would see in the market, with ancillaries such as assistance, personal accident, or legal protection. The synergies, we are also very excited about what we can do because fundamentally you don't have a overlap with our business today. In Italy, we have a very strong PNC business through our agents. We have, through the acquisition of Nobis, a specialized play in the automotive part of the business. And now we have, with Prima, the possibility to be the market leader in direct with 40% market share. So no overlap and great synergies. We are thinking in three directions in particular. When we will sum up all of that, we'll have more than 7 million customers. Imagine what we can do from a claims procurement standpoint. Imagine what we could do by cross-selling on our customer base. And very importantly as well, complementing the product range of each of those channels with the offer of Prima and the offer, our classic offer within Prima. So a lot of, I'd say, standalone potential, fabulous momentum, a very profitable business that stems from competitive edge and some good synergies that we see ahead.
Thank you, Patrick. And just to add a few more numbers when it comes to the run rate. So 2024 was a result of 87 million. The top line growth is 40%. And if you look at the Q1 this year compared to Q1 last year, this year versus H1 last year, their result has doubled. So it's, as Patrick said, a very disruptive model with a very interesting and good dynamic. Scott, on the commercial line pricing.
Sure, Thomas, thank you. David, just to give you a sense of the color for our business, you know, for casualty at the half year, rates continue to meet or exceed trend. We're still around, you know, the plus 8% for the overall casualty portfolio at the half year. So we consider that to be, you know, slightly better than trend, and we're doing well there on pricing. Property is gone slightly negative, mainly because of the mix. It's a little heavier in the U.S. in the second quarter, slightly negative, although that's coming off of 5, 6, 7 years of double-digit rate increases. So that particular business is performing very, very well. So it's not overly surprising. There's been a slight pricing moderation on the property portfolio. And then for financial lines business or professional business, it's still negative, but we're starting to see signs that that's starting to ameliorate. So our sort of thinking going forward is that while continues to remain negative, it'll start to get better as we work through the back half of the year. So all up, we're pretty comfortable in the portfolio and where the pricing's at today.
And so, David, I think you had also a question on the retail improvement, and I will comment on life and health. So retail improvement, that's across the board in Europe. What you see is very strong price increases, around 5%, and except in the UK. And so you do see the benefit of that across the board. But even in the UK, we see an improvement of our loss ratio in retail. So that's, as I said, really across the board that we benefit from those higher margins. On your question of life and health, so you're right. It could have been better. So the way it goes is the following. On the health side, there was a strong focus, as we described, on improving the margins, and pure short-term health, the loss ratio went down by 80 bips between 1H24 and 1H25. But in life and health, we also have the protection, the short-term protection book, which is mainly French. And on this, we saw a deterioration of 70 bips. That comes from more sick leaves in France that we have to indemnify. So we need to reprice that book, and that will be done for next year. But in the meantime, we have that slight deterioration. When you mix the two, and obviously the health book is much larger than the protection book, you have that improvement of 40 bips overall.
Thank you to all of you. So we go to the next question.
Okay, next question is from Will Hardcastle from UBS. Will, you can turn on your microphone and go ahead. Thank you.
Thanks very much. The first question is thinking that you're both a buyer and a seller of reinsurance, and I guess could you discuss whether you view a softening market in reinsurance as a positive or negative from a group basis, and do you buy retro perhaps for the reinsurance that can help dampen some impacts? The second question is regarding the P&C reinvestment yield. It's 4.3% at the half year. It's still well in excess of the average book yield. But what does the 4.3% dilute down to when you consider other assets outside of fixed income? I'm trying to essentially understand that there's still a spread to move up from here. And the third one is just looking at the low levels of P PYD coming out of both personal lines and Excel. Can you discuss if there's anything specific to call out, or is just more good results elsewhere? Anything specifically on US social inflation? Thank you.
So thank you, Will, for your three questions. I guess they are all for Alban. Maybe a quick comment on the low PYD. You should see that as extremely positive. I mean, they are really low. And I would like to point out that at XL, the PYD is zero. So it really shows the very good quality of our results. But Alban will go into more detail.
So as you said, we are both a buyer and seller of reinsurance. To put things in perspective, you see that on an annual basis, XL Re's earnings are around 500 million. But we cede more than 2.5 billion of margins through ceded reinsurance. So those two are not directly comparable, but that gives a view on the importance of both. So I would say overall we will benefit more than we would lose with softer rates. On the reinvestment yield, so yes, we are investing at a higher rate than the current book yield, and we believe we can continue doing so. And so we are confident in our ability to keep on investing our investment return in PNC and what we call non-VFA business, i.e. Investment income that you directly see in your P&L. There's always a bit of volatility around this coming from PE fund distribution, but the trend is clearly positive on investment income thanks to our higher investment yield. And finally, on PYDs, at the end of the day, you saw that we had a good semester on CAT, a good semester on discount. We saw absolutely no need to have higher PYDs.
Thank you, Alban. Thanks, Will, for your question. We go to the next one.
Next question is from William Hawkins from KBW. William, you can turn on your microphone and go ahead.
Well, thank you very much. Hello, all. At the full year, you showed a slide to demonstrate how you are compounding value for shareholders that pointed to growing book value to €24.5 at the end of last year. That figure was €22 at the end of June, so it's back to 2022 levels. I know that's largely FX, but FX is still real. So I'm wondering how, when you're thinking about value creation, how does building book value fit into the wider framework of the metrics that you highlight in the presentation? Second question, please. More numbers-based. The €4.8 billion of normalized cap gen in the solvency walk, how much of that was non-life and how much was life, please? And can you also just give me a bit of an outlook for required capital? The 400 seemed a bit on the high side after 600 for all of last year. So should I just annualize it, or is there some seasonality? And then lastly, a very short question. Frederick, in passing, you mentioned that you're already top three in four direct markets. Can you just tell me what those four markets are, please? Thank you.
Good. So I suggest Frederick does the first question around the compounding shareholder value. Alban, you take the second and third one around required capital and the split life, non-life of the 4.8 billion. And on the markets direct, it is France, Belgium and Ireland. And Spain as well. So that's the fourth one, exactly. So Frederick, on the first question.
Yes, so on the net asset value, what I can tell you is the following. First, as you've noticed, the negative impact we have is the currency impact. And we are a heavily diversified group, so it doesn't worry us at all. I would say it happens, and I think one of the beauties of AXA is to have this diversification. Second comment is that, yes, we have at AXA now a higher focus on the growth of the net asset value. We believe that over the long term, this is an important KPI for us, and we will continue to focus on growing the net asset value in the future, despite the short-term currency movements, if I may say.
So, on the operating return, The 4.8, you have 3.1 billion coming from PNC, you have minus 0.6 coming from holding, which is our holding's earnings. You obviously have 0.2 positive coming from asset management, and the rest comes from life and health. And the increase in required capital, it's true that it's slightly higher than than half of last year. I would say it can depend on the mix of business, but we have good organic growth, and that's the reflection of that.
Thank you, Alban and Frédéric. We go to the next question.
Next question is from Hadley Cohen from Morgan Stanley. Hadley, please turn on your microphone and go ahead.
Hi, morning everyone. Thanks very much. First question is around solvency, please. Can you give us an update of how you're thinking about the pro forma solvency ratio? So we have a 6-point hit from the Prima acquisition, but can you also give us an update on how you're thinking around the effect of the loss of the grandfathered debt from the beginning of next year? And then maybe remind us on how much of that is offset by the solvency review benefit from the beginning of 2027, I guess, particularly in the context of the Commission's report a couple of weeks ago. So that's my first question. Second question is more of a clarification point, please. Thanks, Alban, for the sensitivity of the impact of the dollar on earnings. Does that include currencies that are sort of pegged to the dollar? So I'm thinking like Hong Kong dollar and what have you. But I'm on top of that, I guess I'm also cognizant that the euro has been strong against most currencies in the first half of the year. So if currencies stay where they are now for the second half of the year, what's the overall sort of FX impact that we should think about? Thanks very much.
Thank you, Hadley, for both questions. Alban, I guess these are both for you, bearing in mind that on the solvency revision it's obviously too early to give any indication or concrete indication of what it means, because we are talking about 2027.
So on Prima, as we said, it's going to be 4 points at closing. I just want to highlight the fact that this includes not only the impact of the acquisition of the 51% stake, but also the impact of the put and call options that we have over time. So it's the best, because that's the way accounting works, and so that's the best estimate of the cost that we will have when we exercise those options. That's the first point. On the grandfathered debt, you know that, well, you may not know, but the amount of grandfathered debt is 4.3 billion. So you can do the math on the impact. Obviously, we have issued 2 billion of sub-debt in May in anticipation of that, and we will keep on managing that grandfather debt and issuance to mitigate the impact on our solvency. Last, on the solvency to review, as Thomas said, it's way too early to give a definitive number, so I would repeat what we said in previous periods, which is that overall for every player on the market, it should be a positive impact between plus 10 and plus 20. That's what we can say at this stage. On the FX, so what I said on the dollar does include our operations in Hong Kong that are obviously denominated in the Hong Kong dollar with the peg, and we have no other operation with a peg to the dollar. I cannot give you immediately what the impact would be for the yen, but you have the sensitivities of that in our URD, and Anu very kindly gave that to me a second ago, so I can comment on that. On the yen, a 10% variation is 1% of our underlying earnings group share. Thank you, Anu.
Thank you, but I want to remind you again, these FX movements are happening, but this will not lead to any change in our ambition and target delivery. We will make sure that we will compensate this through operational measures. Next question.
Next question is from James Shuck from Citi. James, please turn on your microphone and go ahead.
Thank you and good morning. I just wanted to ask first off around the commercial lines P&C development. I'm looking at the attritional loss ratio, which kind of ticked up 30 basis points at 1H. I think the plan, the plan period was for commercial lines attritional loss ratio to remain broadly stable. We're talking about XL being pretty flat and SME getting a bit better. Is that kind of still how you see it? Obviously XL seems to be deteriorating and we're seeing rate that slowed in 2Q, running about 2.6% at 1H. So claims inflation is probably more than that. So it looks like to me as if the commercial lines attritional might be getting worse over the planned period than perhaps you anticipated, but just some comments there would be helpful. Secondly, on Primo, I mean, if you're able to give me a split of the expense ratio, please, into the, I suppose it's commission and non-commission expenses, that'd be very helpful. Just keen to understand the size of their expense ratio advantage. I'd imagine the acquisition costs are still quite high, but if they are low, then what's keeping that low? And then finally, Thomas, I mean, how do you see something like Prima, you know, which is a greatest disruptor you've seen in the sector, you know, currently, and as you just highlighted, you know, what does that say about your existing direct business? Because you're bringing all of these things in-house and you've got massive scale advantage, but then, you know, you have this new upstart that comes along and shows you how to do it. So you mentioned you could keep the platforms separate, but is there something that doesn't work in this direct business as part of a large conglomerate? Thank you.
Very good. Thank you, James. Just a few comments and then I hand over to Alban for the combined ratio question and then on Prima to Frédéric. On the combined ratio improvement in general, remember we always said that we look at P&C, commercial and personal lines together when it comes to the improvement. So, and look, we are not at the end of the plan yet. Our aim is clearly to achieve the improvements that we have put forward. And secondly, when it comes to Prima, Prima is today mainly in Italy. It has started in Spain and the UK. But when you look at what we said earlier, the question that William was asking, it is not by coincidence that in four markets we are in the top positions of our direct business, where Prima is not. So these businesses in France, in Belgium, in Ireland, in Spain work extremely well. Alban.
Thank you, Thomas. And then, hello, James. So if you remember what we said at the moment of the plan, we said that we would improve our combined ratio in P&C by 200 bips. And part of that was loss ratio, part of that was expense ratio. So, and clearly when we designed our plan a couple of years ago, we had in mind that the large commercial lines market would probably plateau or slightly deteriorate. So that's what we see in some lines of business today, but we'll see also improvement and good momentum in some other lines. I'm thinking, for instance, of casualty in the US. So when you look at XL, so the XL loss ratio attritional has deteriorated by 80 bips, but 20 bips in that is purely a mix effect, because as casualty prices increase more than the rest, casualty takes also a bit more weight in the overall loss ratio. But what we are saying very clearly is that XL, again, over the plan period, should maintain its underlying earnings in dollar terms, because that potential deterioration in the loss ratio can be offset by better investment income, better expenses, and growth. And on the other commercial lines that some of our competitors put in retail, notably the SME, we saw an improvement of 30 bips in the loss ratio, and we see potentials for further improvement.
On the expense ratio, before answering your question on the expense ratio, I'd like to enlarge the answer, saying that first, our physical distribution channels are doing extremely well. And this is important to have this in mind, and especially our agents. And why are they doing extremely well when we hear about bank branches in difficulties and so on? First, because our agents are entrepreneurs, which changes a lot, and they do not close at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and they work on weekends. And this is, they provide the right service and the right advice to our customers. So this is about the overall picture about our agents. Having said that, we believe that we may be at an inflection point and that direct in the coming years will grow more than other distribution channels for many reasons, especially for because of new generation. And we see that also in the banking business, as you know. So what does a direct player offer? A direct player offers lower prices, and a direct player offers convenience. I mean, this is, you can buy a motor policy during the night without moving from your home and so on. I mean, these are the two key critical points and the two added values that the direct business brings. More specifically on the price, so for price-sensitive clients, it is clear that for specific business lines, especially motor, but true also for the home business, with direct, you can offer lower prices. And you can offer lower prices for two reasons. The first one is direct players have lower expense ratios. If I look at the expense ratio of Prima, it's about 16%. If I look at the expense ratio of our other direct operations, we are always below 20%. If you look at the expense ratio of intermediated business, retail businesses, I would say it's overall 30%. If you're a market leader, it can be at 28. But let's say that direct players have a 10 points competitive advantage compared to intermediated players. Then direct players are also more segmented, and they are focused on, they are extremely segmented with a high pricing sophistication, which generalist players cannot be. In other words, of course, we are segmented, but usually the client that come to our agents have many different products with us and so on, so you cannot be very segmented. So again, 16% for Prima, highly competitive, and probably can still improve. So this is a real disruption.
Thank you, Frédéric and Alban. Let's move to the next question.
Next question is from Michael Huttner from Berenberg. Michael, please turn on your microphone and go ahead.
Yeah, fantastic. A big praise. I follow lots of companies. The fact that you deliver 8% half year on half year and, you know, and say whatever happens to currencies with it is, given some of the companies I cover, I'm beginning to realize how hard that is. So that takes me to my first question, which is, and I hope that you will answer, Thomas, since you've been very quiet today. And the first question is, clearly you could have said, no, we'll do 10% EPS growth or 9 or whatever the figure might be, because you know, there was a lot of buffers you're building. And can you talk about, my guess is what you're implicitly thinking is that you're saying, well, I'll invest for growth. I'll deliver the earnings, but I'll invest for growth. I think the introductory remarks, you stress the long-term nature of the growth outlook rather than delivering more now. I just wondered whether you can articulate, if that's right, if you can articulate this a little bit better and also give us some figures on how much you're investing or, you know, what the investment amount is. So we can have a figure for the payback, if you like. The second question is a really silly one and is maybe more for Alba. Alba, you kind of brushed away. You say, yeah, FX, 1.2 or 1 or 2%, I can do it. where's the fat? I'd love to be able to offset, it sounds like 140 or maybe 200 million. I don't think I'll ever be able to do that, but it may be some idea of that. And then the last question is a pure number one. I apologize for that. 11 times. Can you unpack what it's a ratio of? I still don't know how much you're paying for Prima. I mean, I know 500 million. But the rest is I don't know. I've heard 1.1 billion. And then linked to Prima, you're only related to the Italian premiums. It looks as if you're throwing away the remaining 200. That's it. Thanks.
Thank you, Michael, for your question. We do, as you said, Alban will tackle the second one, and we give the third one to Patrick because... we are, as you've seen, only buying 51%, which represents the 500 million. The total value is 1.1, but Patrick will explain a bit more in detail. So on your first question, for me, it's important that we have, if you look at the transition of AXA, we have shifted the portfolio to more earnings predictability, to more cash-related earnings, and you can see with our earnings power that this has worked very well. We are in the phase now of focusing mainly on organic growth development, and you've also seen, given the fact that all geographies, all lines of business are contributing, we are very well executing on our priorities and have found back to a good growth momentum. Because if you go back to 2016, we were not at 7% growth of our revenues. We were probably in slight minus territory. And I think this should make us all very proud that we have created this momentum. Secondly, we are not, looking at three-year plans and then we don't know what is happening afterwards. For us, the three-year plan is just an intermediate target that we want to achieve. And as you heard from my comments, we are already looking beyond how does the story continue. And in order to fuel a continuous growth story, you also need to invest. And therefore, we try and balance these investments for growth and the delivery well. So where do we invest for growth today, and what is already in these numbers? You have a big initiative that is happening in the US where we want to accelerate with XL. We have a big initiative in Asia, in Hong Kong, around wealth management. You have a lot of initiatives in Europe around mid-market and other areas. So our numbers do include the investments already for tomorrow, and I think that is also what a responsible company should do to sustain earnings. We do believe that we have the capacity to deliver our plan in the range of 6 to 8%, and yes, we have enough margin to swallow negative effects, because if you remember last year, we had many adverse effects from the discounting, from the OECD tax, and we also managed to cover it because when you look at also our reserve base, when you look at how prudent we are, we have the necessary comfort to deliver our plan and swallow those negative FX impacts. So, Alban, second question around how to offset the 1.2. You can go into detail. And maybe you also do the Prima one, because I have probably given half the answer already, and then you can go into a bit more detail.
Thank you, Thomas. On the FX, obviously it has an impact. What we are saying is that we feel strongly about our earnings in the first half, and that we are confident that we would be able to offset the impact of FX in the second half with the magnitude that we have described during this call, with better earnings. That's what we are saying. There is no magic behind that. On Prima, So when we say it's 11 times, that's the sum of three things. It's the price that we are paying today for 51%, so 0.5 billion. That's the fact that when we recapture the premiums, because as you know, Prima is an MGA, we will have to inject roughly 0.2 billion in the carrier that will do that. And last, that's the best estimate of what we will pay in 4 or 5 years when we exercise the call options, discounted to today. And so when I do the sum of all this and compare that to today's earnings of Prima, it's 11 times. I think what really matters is what was said earlier on Prima's earnings growth capacity, which is extremely impressive. So the 11 times is, from my point of view, more than reasonable.
I think Alban has been extremely clear, but I want to reinforce his point. I'll say it in the following way. For our half-year results, we've done a cautious closing. And this cautious closing makes us confident that we can compensate for future FX negative impacts, and that we can continue to invest in our future growth, having in mind the next plan.
Thank you, Michael, for your question. Let's move to the next one.
Next question is from Farouk Hanif from JP Morgan. Please, Farouk, turn on your microphone and go ahead.
Hi, everybody. Thanks so much. Just going back to, firstly, the point on casualty in AXA XL. Can you tell us how much of your premium is in casualty in XL now? And obviously, it will have grown because of pricing, but are you sort of chasing share there in any form? Secondly, on the point about your reserving strength, I mean, I'm looking at slide 32 in your appendix. I know you can't really use claims reserves ratios. They're a very blunt tool and they don't really always mean anything. But I note that your incurred claims to net earned premium is down at a low point, you know, compared to, I mean, back at full year 18 levels. And I was wondering whether we need to read anything into that. And my last question is on the financial result, the investment margin. So obviously going back to Will's question, it feels like investment income can improve, but obviously your financial result is a spread. Having said that, like in the first half, it looked like that spread was also stronger. So I was wondering if you think that, you know, that kind of net between investment income and discount rate unwind going forward will continue to be also growing. Thank you.
Thank you, Farouk, for your questions. I suggest Scott will take the first one on casualty, and then Alban will talk about the reserving piece, obviously making sure that we're treating 2019 and prior differently to post-2019. And then, Alban, if you could also talk about investment income at the end. Scott.
Sure. Thank you, Thomas. Farouk, on the casualty portfolio for AXA XL Insurance, it's approximately 30% of our business. So, and it's been pretty steady around that number over the last 4 or 5 years. We're not, quote unquote, chasing anything here. What we do is we look at each risk and we adequately determine if the pricing is adequate and if the particular product line, the pricing is adequate, we might write a little bit more of that. But in today's, the mixed number has stayed pretty steady over the last 4 or 5 years in terms of casualty relative to the rest of the insurance portfolio.
On the reserving, so exactly as you said, Farouk, looking at the page 32 is a very gross indication, and especially when you have top line growth of 7% in P&C, 6% in P&C. That brings your ratio down mechanically because your reserves do not grow at the same pace, and that's normal. I would just say that on casualty at XL, we have obviously very sophisticated ways to look at it, but a very simple way is to say how much IBNR for how much case reserve. And we have significantly increased that ratio over the last 3 years. And last, on investment income, you're right. I was commenting on investment income, not the spread between investment income and unwind. I think it can nevertheless increase, but at a lower pace than investment income itself.
Even if your question was focused on casualty US, I'd like to make a comment on casualty outside of the US because we never discuss it. Casualty in Europe and emerging market is an extremely good business. And we have a specific initiative at AXA to grow this business because, again, this is a business which is well-priced, good underwriting, and this is very often in many geographies our most profitable business, so be it in Europe but also in emerging markets. So we should have this view that there is casualty US, and we're happy with our business, the casualty business in the US, but we're also happy with the level we underwrite in the US, but we also have a business in Europe and emerging markets and casualty which is extremely good.
Thank you. Thank you, Farouk. Let's go to the next question.
Next question is from Dominic O'Mahony from BNP Paribas Exane. Dominic, please turn on your microphone and go ahead.
Hello, folks. Thanks for taking questions. I've got one main question and then a couple of details left. Just on the discounting in P&C, flat versus H1 last year, I was really positively surprised by that. I mean, I was expecting quite a deterioration given what's happened to yields. I wonder if you could just unpack how you've managed to keep it flat and the extent to which that's, you know, a secular function of business mix, which means it will persist, or are there some one-off factors in there which mean that we should look through the particular print? More detailed question. We've talked quite a lot about currency effects on the financials. I'm really just wondering whether you observe any change in the actual business sales. So, for instance, is there any sign that appetite for US dollar-denominated policies in Asian markets, that customers are wary of those products in light of the currency volatility? And then finally, Alban, I think you said, correct me if I'm wrong, that UK retail margins improved in the period versus first half 24. Clearly the pricing dynamic is weaker in the UK, as you mentioned, versus continental Europe. What's driving that improvement in the performance? Thank you.
Thank you, Dominic, for your questions. So on the discounting PNC, I suggest Alban will talk about this. When it comes to the currency, I think we need to differentiate two types of business. One is obviously the commercial business. Scott should talk about that. And the other one is more the life insurance business in Asian markets, in particular in Japan, because that's where you had the phenomenon of US dollar-denominated life insurance. On this one, we see that demand has actually weakened for it for a couple of reasons. Number one, the interest rate situation in Japan has changed, even though it hasn't dramatically changed. And secondly, some tax advantages on what's called COLI products in Japan has changed, which has driven more demand towards yen-denominated policies. And the same is true if you have, for example, Mexico, where you have some health policies in US dollar, because the delta between health costs in Mexico and the US has certainly gone apart. These products are less offered and therefore less sold. And I think then on the third piece around UK retail, Patrick will talk about it. When Alban was referring to UK retail, he was referring to health earlier. What is important is that maybe Patrick gives a little more detail around health, motor, and household, because the trends are relatively different. So, Alban, on the first one, discounting factor.
Thank you, Thomas. So, and hello, Dominique. On the discounting, so we don't manage the discount effect because it's simply mechanical and not manageable. So what happened? It's a mix of two things. One that everyone has in mind is the function of the discount rate, which is the market rate. But then there is something else, which is also the amount of unpaid claims for the business written in this first half. So it's a question of business mix. If you say write more casualty, more financial lines, for which typically the amount of claims paid in the current year is low, you will have more unpaid claims and therefore more discount benefit. I hope that that clarifies.
Thank you, Alban. On the second question, Scott, on the currency effects, do you see anything in commercial when it comes to programs and so on that people switch currencies?
Sure. Thank you, Thomas. Dominic, we're not seeing any changes relative to the denomination in our policies. And I just want to be clear, when we underwrite, we have a very clear rule that your limits that you buy have to match the premium that you pay in the currency, in the sense, so if you're buying U.S. limits for example, a property policy, the premium is also paid in U.S. dollars. So we always match the currency of the exposure that we're insuring relative to the premium payment. And generally speaking, the clients aren't really focused on that piece of FX. It's just making sure you're insured to value in whatever country that you're operating in. So again, we're not seeing, and it's not typical, when we see currency movements, we really don't usually see movements of the currency within our policies.
Thank you, Scott. And then Patrick, on UK retail, if you could then differentiate as well health, motor, and non-motor.
Absolutely. Thanks, Dominique, for the question. So I will start with UK health and give you a little bit the dynamics and the reason behind a very, very positive development. We have a massive increase of our earnings on the UK health, above 170% versus half year last year. And if you remember N23, we told you no stone would be unturned to bring this book back to its profitability. It's a great business, got 20% market share. And that's exactly what we did. No stones were unturned. We've put in very strong price increases. We've sophisticated our pricing. We've enhanced our ability to price more frequently. And very, very, very importantly, we've totally reshuffled our claims activities, which means we have a steering to our preferred networks that move from 45% end of 23 to now 80%. We invested heavily in fraud, waste, and abuse. And very importantly, we acquired a small company that helps us developing medical pathways, i.e. Medical protocols that we put in place to make sure that on one end you have the best medical outcome for the customers, but there is also a cost efficiency process that enables to remove the waste. And you know that in health, 30% globally, I'm not talking here about AXA, but 30% of all spending is wasted. You add to this some expense reduction efforts that we're doing through AI and GenAI, in particular in our call centers, and you add up to this result with a very significant improvement in the combined ratio of around 5 points. Very importantly, I said it's a great business. We believe there is still more to be earned in the second half of 25. Get the full impact of the price increase we had in 24, but also the impact of the pricing increase that we've put in 25 from 8 to 15% pending the lines. We see a top line rebound. I'm very pleased with that. We have a top line growth of 6%, and we feel this is a good momentum that will continue, and we will continue to be totally obsessed with claims and get very strong benefit from that perspective. So that's for the health bit. On the UK retail, you're right. You talked about, I believe in your question, the market softening. So it's true, the market softens around 5% in the first half of the year. We are very clear on what we need to do in the UK, which is to prioritize profitability and customer retention. And that's what we're doing. So I'm super pleased to see on one end that if you look back to 2023, combined ratio improved more than 17 points. And if you look half year versus half year, it's an improvement of 4 points. And this is almost all driven by attritional, which means, you know, greater quality, obviously, of the portfolio. So that's on one end, the profitability. On the other end, we're regaining net new customers. So we're growing our customers, our customer base. This is stemming from, in part, the new deal we have with Lloyds Banking Group, which is a leading banking group in the UK with 28 million customers. So we feel there's a lot of potential to be captured. And we're very interested also by that partnership, because it's data rich and enables us to sophisticate our pricing and to select well the risks. Back from the turnaround, it's things that I had explained in previous sessions. Again, here it has been a totally reshuffling of our pricing capabilities, from the pricing sophistication to the pricing tools, i.e. our ability to have a full deployment of our models in rating engines, and sophistication between linear and non-linear models. I wouldn't get in that detail. And again, claims, huge effort from fraud detection to procurement to also re-internalization of our intervention team. So if you look at our rate of capture from that perspective, it has moved from 16% to 25%. So we've really moved the needle on what makes the technical excellence, and we'll keep being very, very disciplined in prioritizing profitability, customer retention, and fueling the top line through that very interesting deal we have with Lloyds.
Thank you, Patrick. We take one last question. I think Andrew Crean is next in line. If there are any further questions beyond Andrew's questions, our team is obviously ready to answer all of them, but the time is advanced. So, Andrew, a last question.
Thomas, couple of questions. Firstly, you talked in your opening remarks about improving the ambition and the combined ratio that you want out of health beyond this plan. Could you enumerate a little bit as to how big an improvement you're targeting? Secondly, in terms of XL insurance, you quoted the rates in both casualty and property. But I wanted to understand what the rate movement was in the US, because half XL insurance business is outside the state. So could you talk a little bit about rate in the states in casualty and property, and whether you see that as, you know, are you building margin, holding margin, or losing margin?
Thank you, Andrew, for your two questions. I suggest Scott will answer the second question. On the first question, what I've said is, and this goes very much also back to the question we had around Michael's first question. When we think about the health business, we are looking at it in the long term, not only given this plan. What we have seen in many markets, notably in Spain, Mexico, Mexico, Egypt and others, that if you do partner or operate in health with medical facilities, so clinics that, not hospitals, but clinics that handle 70-80% of the base load, you can have a very strong influence on the one hand around your claims cost, because you make sure that you help the customer from very early on to find the right doctor in the medical jungles that do exist today. And secondly, you can also reduce fraud, waste and abuse through this. And we have decided to continue this investment plan and to continue investing in those clinic facilities in order to make sure that in all of our markets where this applies and where we have a positive impact on health, and it's mainly in markets where you have a high what we call out-of-pocket pay, so where there is no sufficient state system and the customer has to pay a certain amount him or herself. And so when we talk about how big is the improvement, I guess I will have to defer you until the end of next year when we launch our next plan. But clearly, health is an important business for us and a strategic business, and you will see in the next plan an ambition around growth and profit improvement around this, based on the strategy of more assets in vertical integration. Scott, on your question around the insurance, the rates in the US on casualty and property, and how is rate and margin movement?
Sure. Thank you, Thomas. Andrew, to give you a little more color on the difference, and you understand that a lot of our business written outside the United States can have obviously US exposures to it, and we would price that business, obviously consideration of the U.S. exposures that they have. But to give you perspective, for example, excess casualty for us from a pricing standpoint is up around 15%, in the U.S. And that compares, for example, with our essentially non-U.S. generated casualty business of around 6 and change. So that gives you a little perspective of those differences. In terms of property, it's a little closer. The all up portfolio we talked about being slightly negative of a couple of points. The U.S., for the first half year is around -5. So it's a little bit more, than what we're seeing in the, non-U.S. business, but the, that business was heavily skewed to the first, quarter. So the market's moved a little bit since then. So, it's not surprising that the U.S. book, which is more of a second quarter book than the first quarter, would be a little bit lower on the rate number.
Thank you, Scott. Thank you for your participation and all your questions. As I said, if there are questions remaining, our team is there to answer all of the remaining questions. In the meantime, I wish you a great summer and hope to see you soon. Thank you very much.